Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Welcome to this board meeting. We are going to discuss macro hedging. I hear we are first going to discuss paper 4B to be presented by Luigi.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I know. Okay. I'm sorry.
That's how we like to hear.
Okay. The paper 4B, the title is Treatment of Unrecognized Items, Loan Commitments, and Pipeline Trades, continues the discussion on the proposed revaluation model. So far, the discussion relating to hedged items has been limited to situations in which the hedged risk exposure resulted from recognized financial instruments, balance sheet items. However, common risk management approaches also consider interest rate risk resulting from transactions that A, already exist but are not recognized for accounting purposes, such as many loan commitments, and B, transactions that are not yet executed, i.e. that do not yet exist. For example, forecast issue volumes of products at advertised rates, colloquially referred to as pipeline trades. From the perspective of interest rate risk management approaches in the banking sector, the interest rate risk that arises from unrecognized items such as loan commitments and pipeline trades is similar to that on recognized financial instruments. As long as these items are existing items, contracts, there is no conceptual obstacle for applying the same accounting model for macro hedging as for recognized financial assets and liabilities. This allows loan commitments to be integrated into the revaluation model. In contrast, justifying the inclusion of pipeline trades in the hedge risk position that are not based on binding legal requirements would require conceptual concessions, i.e. accepting inconsistencies with the conceptual framework and IFRS. First, it can result in recognizing gains or losses from forecast transactions. Second, accounting for fair value risk from forecast transactions implicitly means considering the effect of economic compulsion for accounting purposes. And finally, it leads to the recognition of items that could be considered akin to internally generated goodwill. With that, I turn it over to the board for discussion.
Paul.
If I turn it off.
I think the staff are going is not to do macro hedging for these, and I would support that direction. I do not see an inconsistency with what we now do on accounting for forecast transactions, which is to recognize, to allow hedging for those, because for those, we're accounting for the derivative. Here, we're accounting for something that is not on our books, or we would be accounting for something that's not on our books. And I see that as an important difference. And so I would favor not going down the direction of recognizing these in the macro hedging project, even though I do support the hedge of cash flow hedge of a forecast transaction.
This is one bridge too far.
One bridge too far.
Philippe? I totally agree with what Paul has said. If it was possible to identify those hedging instruments that cover or hedge those pipeline trades, we would have cash flow hedge, but by definition, because it is a macro hedge, you cannot identify specifically those things. So, for the same reasons, I support what you are saying and what Paul said.
Stephen.
My understanding is that
even if we didn't put this in the macro model, an entity could still get cash flow hedge accounting for these things under the general model.
Yeah.
So if it's a bridge too far for the macro model, why would we still keep it in the general model under cash flow hedging?
Well, there is a one-to-one relationship in that case.
The conceptually speaking, we believe that pipeline trades could not be the items in the fair value hedges. However, there is an issue of using alternative solution using cash flow hedge for pipeline trades. My understanding is that there are some choices for the board for the alternative solutions. The first one is that you don't accept cash flow hedge for pipeline trades as long as the management sees fair value risks in pipeline trades. The other solution is to accept cash flow hedges. But the problem is that it might be a flavor of artificial solution because once the bank can luckily find floating rate fundings in somewhere in the balance sheet, you can do cash flow hedges, but it does not necessarily reflect actual risk management. So there is an issue in how we cope with the
I think it's important to understand that if you get cash flow hedging, it would be for a different hedged item that you need to designate. It would not be your pipeline trade that you could designate. So you need to look at something else, and then you have this.
What would you designate?
Variable rate funding. So that is a cash flow exposure that if you have it, you could hedge. You cannot use cash flow hedging for the pipeline trade. Today, that is simply not eligible as any type of hedged item.
So suppose you have fixed rate mortgages as pipeline trades, but you have to find, in order for you to use cash flow hedge, you have to find some variable rate instruments. So for example, if you are lucky enough to find floating rate funding, you can use cash flow hedges, but it might be hard.
So again, it's about connecting two things. You have, say, advertised that you will issue fixed rate mortgages, and you will finance that with variable rate funding. And then you have a swap that converts the fixed flows and bridges them with the variable flows to lock in your margin. So then you can say, well, if I can't look at it as a fair value hedge of the pipeline trades, I look at the other side, the funding, and fix the funding. So basically, we end up both sides fixed or both sides variable, depending on how you look at it. The swap actually bridges fixed versus variable. But then the problem is that you now look at a different hedged item. And if you want to build a comprehensive revaluation model, obviously, then you need to take out that individual designated hedged item and can't leave that also in the whole revaluation approach, because then it gets accounted for twice. So that's then the complexity that you get into. That's why the last paragraph in the paper sets out that conceptually, if you accept what we have in terms of IFRS generally so far and the framework we have, then that's pretty clear for the reasons set out in the paper that it is not, for accounting purposes, this fixed rate fair value type exposure. But once you take that out and force another solution, obviously, then it has knock-on impacts on other parts of the model. And that's really the decision that you need to make, or the evaluation, how important is it to stay pure on this issue and the knock-on effects it otherwise has.
Okay. Martin? I don't think really that we have a solution for this pipeline trades with cash flow hedging, because what we are doing then is, what Martin explained, is some artificial, I think, allocation of variable rate deposits to future pipeline trades, which I think is not a good reflection of the risk management of interest rate risk in the banks. And my understanding was what we want to achieve is really with the macro hedge model to get a better understanding and reflection in accounting of interest rate risk management in banks. And so I think, why should we exclude it from the first hand? And I understand there is some problems with our framework if we're doing that, allowing that. But on the other hand side, I think we want to discuss in the next years about our framework, and I don't think that we should exclude it now before we have done really all the discussion on the framework. And overall, as I said, I don't think there is a solution there. It's maybe an artificial solution, but our general purpose should be, I think, with macro hedging compared to the old IAS 39 macro hedge model, which is artificial in some banks because they're allocating things with not risk management together. And overall purpose should be, I think we should reflect with a macro hedge model if we go this route, risk management, interest rate risk management in a bank, and I don't really think we should exclude it now. We should bring it into the discussion paper, and then if it have conflicts with the framework, maybe we have to discuss it in parallel with the framework project.
Of course, our analysis is focusing on the consistency with existing framework. So,
I understand that, yeah.
So, if you find a possibility for the changing framework, yeah, yeah, there would be another discussion.
Yeah, but we have only, with cash flow hedging, we have achieved that it is not against our framework because we putting then the fair value in OCI, and therefore we have not really a problem with our framework. Yeah. This is kind of tricky, I understand yeah. that, but if you look through that substantially, if you have a cash flow hedge or fair value hedge in these circumstances, is economically not any different. But we have found a solution with cash flow hedging to overcome our concerns with the framework. But even my point is, okay, when we discuss framework overall, why we should now exclude it, because it is against our current framework if we want to issue a discussion paper on that.
Yeah.
Well, I agree very much with what Martin said, and I hope we'll get this into the discussion paper in a good way. A question here. We read that you talk about interest rate risk related to transactions exist but are not recognized, many loan commitments. Are these transactions agreement that will be fulfilled? Or are they more of like options? I mean, I can get a loan commitment from a bank saying that we commit to give you the coming 12 months, 100 million, whatever currency, at the terms of the market, or LIBOR plus 2% or something. Or are the agreements where we have signed that the 15th of January I will get my 100 million? Because if it is not sort of this firm agreement that will be realized, I think I don't see the difference between the A and B in paragraph one. I think they are both sort of forecast transactions.
I think I broadly understand what you're saying, but what we have differentiated in paragraph one is what exists as an item, it is a contract, and what is an anticipated future contract. And then when you look at paragraph four is the breakdown of 1A. So that's only about the existing items, but then they can be the type of an outright or definite contract, like a forward contract, where you then must take the loan, or it can be a binding contract where you offer it as an option. So that means you have to accept the other party's choice, but you can't back out. The difference to a pipeline trade is that legally, for pipeline trade, you can just say, well, I don't accept basically that you want to have a contract with me. So if you advertise, a pipeline trade is only an invitation to enter into a contract, but you are not committed yet, whereas an option means once the other side says yes, you have to contract at that price. So that makes it fairly different in legal terms, whether you can or cannot avoid legally detrimental economic consequences. I understand that there is a common denominator in terms of estimation that you need to make, because under an option, you don't know until it's exercised or lapses whether you will get taken up on the option, and the same with the pipeline trades. But they are two different dimensions. One is the risk of estimating how much volume you will get, and the other one is if you can avoid getting it or not.
But I mean, if you offer me to say, the coming 12 months you can borrow money from me for 5%, mm-hmm. And then I say, that looks good, let's confirm that I have that option. That is one situation. And if you give the same, say, the coming 12 months you can do it, you can come back to me whenever you want. Mm-hmm. I think that's the same thing.
But it's not.
There's some difference.
Not the same as a pipeline, is it?
Sorry?
It's not the same as a pipeline.
Well, the second is a pipeline and the first is not a pipeline. But from an economic point of view,
yeah.
I think I have exactly the same commitment as a bank.
I think economically very similar. However, I think it depends on the legal system in each jurisdiction. However, the main difference is that it, which is based on legal requirements or not. So in, as long as it is based on the legal requirements, if you want to accept my offer, I have no choice but to accept. I cannot reject. But in case of pipeline trades, legally speaking, I can reject, even though I have made advertisement maybe 3 days ago.
Take an extreme example. So let's say just because of a freak event, the interest rate essentially spikes overnight by 10 percentage points. Now then the pressure obviously comes on. Would the banks still say, well, yeah, I'm still happy to give you the mortgage at 2% if now everybody transacts at 12%? Or would I say, ouch, that's pretty much where I say, never mind the advertising, but sorry, even if the customer's burned for life, I'm not going to do that deal. Whereas if they have an option, the customer smiles and says, you don't want to, but you have to, so give me the 2-year deal, the 2% deal.
I would argue the same for the written contract. I would say, force majeure. There was a war in Greece, and
No, people sue you, and you'll actually need to reimburse them.
But if they have more normal situations, I think you have very similar situations.
Yeah, but that's exactly, you're in the normal situation. That's what we call this economic compulsion. Because if the interest rate changes by 5 basis points, they just do it and don't.
But I don't foresee the revision of the conceptual framework leading to the possible conclusion that pipeline trades are going to be assets.
Or liability.
That is really stretching it.
So. But I don't know where you end up, because man, if you would, for example, end up in saying, okay, the revaluation in a fair value hedge and the net amount would be, let's assume, maybe it is out of thinking, but let's assume we will book it in OCI, then we don't have any difference to a cash flow hedge, which we accept. So our presumption is, okay, that we're doing an asset liability, the revaluation amount, and that is against our current framework, but I think we have not discussed it to an end, and therefore my point earlier was to say, okay, why do ruling that out now? Because we're discussing the conceptual framework in parallel to this document, and economically I think we are all convinced that, okay, it does make sense to include it, but it is against our framework. But to say now in the discussion paper already, okay, we don't want to do it, I don't see that.
But most likely you could do a cash flow hedge on each individual offer you have made. I offered 50 people here sort of a pipeline thing, and I could make
not,
a cash
not flow on that size, as I explained to Steve, not a cash flow hedge for the offer for the mortgage counterparty. You need to look at the other side, the funding side, because there's no cash flow risk there. You will not have cash flow risk because you will transact at the advertised fixed rate, so the cash flows are all fixed. And there is no cash flow risk. That's exactly the problem why people can't get directly cash flow hedge for that.
The variability in cash flows.
But you do run into the conceptual framework, even with those that Jan's talking about. We end up putting things on the balance sheet, orders for things that we would not normally account for, except we...
Would that the consequence be?
Well, I think if you want to have a framework project, there's no point in being close-minded about it.
No, but would you be... Would you, if you were going to allow macro hedging for this kind of situation, would you be putting these pipeline trades on the balance sheet?
That's our question to you. I think what we've said in the paper is, as an asset liability, I can't really see that personally.
No, but whether you go the consequence of if we wanted to allow
yeah,
we would have to put this on the balance sheet.
No, you
and that's, but sorry, but you don't do the pipeline trades on the balance sheet. What you are doing then, if you allow that, it is a revaluation of this pipeline future trade, so the fair value movement of that,
yeah,
that you're putting on the balance sheet because you're allowing a revaluation,
yeah,
but not the
that
trade.
That is very different from a cash flow hedge.
I understand that.
But you say revaluation, it's the value is zero. I mean, you're putting it on the balance sheet.
You're creating something.
You're creating something that wouldn't
about
exist.
Remeasuring something that wouldn't otherwise be recognized.
But why doesn't it exist? The risk exists, right? The risk, okay, that you have, if you have the pipeline trades and you have an interest rate risk from this pipeline trades exist.
And as long as
it is not recognized at the moment.
I understand, yeah, it's not recognized, but you say is nothing existing. The risk is existing.
But you say revalue. I'm not sure what we're revaluing, that's all.
I think you can handle it in different ways. You can say you definitely have the hedging instrument, otherwise we wouldn't talk about it, so that is fair value PL. That's the starting point. And then you say, do I want to do anything about it? If you say, I'm not going to do anything that even this light way could collide with the framework that we have now, then that is the end of the road. And if you say, I want to reflect in the financial statements that there is another side, that this is not just a deal in isolation, but in contemplation of this future business, then what can you do? You can either, what we have in the paper and what Martin said is in presentation terms, say the valuation, so to speak, getting a measurement of the change in risk. That is the number that you can produce, and that is what it is. Then taking this amount into the balance sheet, you could put it into OCI against PL. That would just alleviate the PL volatility noise that comes out of otherwise accounting for the derivative at fair value PL, but would still keep the equity volatility because you only park that in OCI temporarily until you release it when you actually do the pipeline trade later on. If that's not what you want, then you could go one step further, but that definitely takes you into recognizing as asset and liabilities non-existing item, which currently we do not do, and then you would, instead of taking it into OCI, taking it into an asset or a liability in the balance sheet. That is then the view that would most likely treat it as if it were an existing item. Yeah.
If you compare it to cash flow hedges, we also recognize not on the balance sheets and the forecasted transaction, which in your words doesn't exist currently.
Do we?
You don't put it on the balance sheet, but you take consequences because the derivative, which is hedging this unrecognized forecasted transaction, we say, okay, that should not then be fair value through P&L, that should be then booked in OCI. So you have taken consequences out of these unrecognized transactions. And you avoid, in this circumstances, you avoid a conflict with the framework because you don't have put it as an asset or as a liability, but you have taken consequences out of that because the derivatives is not then marked to market through P&L. So there is reflection in the accounting, but it's not then in conflict with the framework. And that is a trick.
Yes.
But then to say, okay, we don't allow anything unrecognized then as an accounting consequence, that is not right, because for cash flow hedging, we have some consequences.
For fair value hedge of a commitment or forecast transaction, we put things on the balance sheet that otherwise are not assets and liabilities, right, at the moment.
Well, we say we don't recognize them. That's the difference. We don't recognize them as an asset or liability. So it's about the recognition criteria. When you look at it, the framework differentiates between what meets the definition and what is then recognized. So you do have many items that meet the definition of an asset or liability but are simply not recognized.
Yeah.
Then to draw an accounting consequence where you override that recognition is obviously not that a big problem because you're still dealing with then different recognition criteria for existing items. But it's one step further when you recognize an item that doesn't even meet the definition. Because that is a completely different conceptual step to overriding the normal default recognition requirements for an existing item. And that's the whole discussion.
Forecast transaction can very well be non-existent.
Forecast transactions by definition are non-existent.
Yeah, so I mean.
And that's why they can't have a fair value as such, because when you say, what do you pay me for a forecast transaction? People say, what? So.
I listened to that conversation with great interest because it was on point with, I guess, some of my thoughts. When I read this paper, I had no objections to, I think, the direction that you were heading in, certainly. But I was actually surprised at the recommendation you were making. Along the lines, I think, of where Martin and Jan are, if in fact macro hedging is intended to represent the way a bank, let's talk about just banks now, financial institution is managing risk, in this particular case interest rate risk, then it would seem to me that you could construct an argument to say that these transactions, in fact, on a probability-weighted basis, just like an option, could in fact be recognized. Now, you could go down the path of what I think you suggested in paragraph 19, where you'd book some of these things in OCI, revalue them into P&L. That, in my mind, would be completely consistent with the theory that you've been espousing now for the last 12 months. But I'm not going to object, trust me. I guess the question I have here is just this. What is the hedge position in an open portfolio? The general hedging model deals with closed portfolios. This deals with open portfolios. In an open portfolio, it's constantly changing. A loan I have on the books today could be gone tomorrow, and a new loan could come in. A deposit I have on the books today could be gone tomorrow, a new one could come in. So in a macro hedging environment, you're constantly making essentially a forecast of really what that changing interest rate position is. Why is this really any different? Why couldn't we throw this into the mix? And if you're drawing the line on the fact that because a contract doesn't exist, I get that. That's a decision. You could call it arbitrary. But from an economic risk management position, I would argue that it's not consistent, that you could make a probabilistic, you know, assessment as to how many of these pipeline things, trades, are going to actually occur and account for them.
I understand your question. It is very hard for me to correctly make a reply to your question, but what the staff is doing is that the basic idea of revaluation model is very simple. But in terms of specific topics, we carefully analyze that the idea is consistent with the accounting IFRS framework. Mm-hmm. So we started from the revaluation model for prepayment mortgages or core demand deposits. We thought it is relatively consistent with framework. But when we go to the next steps, for example, equity model book, it can be consistent with the framework, but there is some doubt. But when we go further to pipeline trades, we thought it is quite difficult to find consistency.
I think the common theme of the discussion is that obviously, like Martin said, the framework will be open, so maybe that's a good thing that this is at the same time because it gives you some input for the other discussion as well, maybe. Yeah. But definitely,
it's complicated enough as it is.
from an economic perspective, you are right that people actually have the main issue, which is modeling their risks.
Right.
And then whether you have an existing contract and whether that has no optionality in it, it has optionality, or you have forecast transaction, that is just each a driver of how difficult your estimate is. That there are also contractually existing exposures that are very difficult to model. And when you look at the deposit modeling, for instance, that's also very difficult. So if it's say, if I accept that they are running the whole shop on this model basis, then I rather have everything in than now slice and dice it with us in and out by normal accounting conventions, and afterwards I discover that actually I lose the plot on my objective was here to have a model that is operational, is holistic, and allows me to understand how it all works together, and now I make the first cut that will ultimately result in I need then to split it into partially accommodating that, another part is accounted for more conventionally, and then the user needs to put it all back together somehow.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
This whole discussion raises in my mind a question which is a bit more general. If an entity decides to adopt the macro hedge model as we propose here, does that mean that it is all inclusive and this is only one model can be applied at the same time, meaning that any form of parallel cash flow hedge or fair value hedge or whatever would be prohibited on a separate part of the book. The book under the macro hedge must be the whole book, and you cannot slice out a bit and say, this one I treat separately because I want to hedge my pipeline trades on that basis.
Well, I think we already had that last board table, quickly the discussion flaring up, or we shortly about. We have not yet a decision or a discussion even whether it should be mandatory or not. We have first started with what might the model be, because I think you can only have a sensible discussion of should it be optional, Should it be mandatory? If so, on what basis? Yeah. For the whole entity, by portfolio? All that discussion you can only have once you know what the model looks like, because that drives whether it is suitable for such an approach and also whether it makes sense. But I think one of the papers that we have already earmarked for bringing back to the board as an issue is then once the model stands, and it would be, in my view, very important to include it in the discussion paper, whether you work on the basis assumption that it would be a choice by the entity, like an accounting choice, more like fair value option hedge accounting. It could be irrevocable based on portfolio level. It could be at a higher level, or whether you're mandatory. And that then exactly relates to the interaction with other hedge accounting alternatives. So depending on whether you make it mandatory, you could also say, I don't make it mandatory, but I say, if that is your situation and describe a macro situation, you can't use general hedge accounting. So those are the different options that you have to steer where people need to be. Ultimately, I think it's the assessment of each board member whether they think the incentive to pick the right model is inherently strong enough that you don't need to overlay that with a requirement, or whether you think there's unhealthy competition between different accounting solutions and then you want to have some mandatory channeling where people need to go.
As I understand, now we can discuss in the future, you know, but in reality, there is possibilities, you know, the entities will manage it both ways, and some at macro levels also, some not outside. But the question is, if there's overlap, you know, what we should require. I'm right?
Yeah, I think it's quite customary that, for instance, if you're a large group, you might have one financing vehicle where you just have packaged funding and some swaps into one financing vehicle that is just on its own. That's just completely done, and you don't need to readjust that. To artificially include that vice versa into a dynamic management wouldn't make sense. So then people can tidy that up with hedge accounting at that level. It doesn't feed risk management-wise even necessarily into the kind of dynamic situation, because there are no adjustments frequently happening there and so on. So in that case, I would not see a conflict or a kind of unhealthy competition between the models. Then people would probably automatically make the right choice. But those are all the considerations you need to have and put in the discussion paper when you say, how do you want to do the scoping and the qualifying criteria for this type of treatment, so that you don't just go gung-ho and it should be all or nothing and try to analyze and differentiate that. But that is a discussion that we should have when we have a paper that lays it out for you essentially what the considerations are and the ways that you could go.
Stephen?
So if we accept that this is a future contract or a contemplation of future business, then what does this do to our decisions or our inclination on demand deposits? Because it seems to me that with a pipeline trade, we're saying that we're anticipating the behavior of the bank. And we don't like anticipating the behavior of the bank in the sense that they're not contracted to accept these things, that but they might just do so anyway. And yet with demand deposits, we're saying, well, we're okay with anticipating the behavior of the customer, because there is no, whilst I've got the deposit today, there is nothing contractual about the deposit tomorrow. We have a behavioral process that suggests that the deposit will stay there tomorrow, but there's nothing contractual about it.
My personal understanding is that as far as demand deposits are concerned, depositors, based on contracts, depositors have a choice, withdraw today, tomorrow, or sometime in the future. So as long, my understanding is the behavior is within the contract. So I understand that behavioralization could be accepted, but pipeline raises different for me.
Like the key difference is that you at least have an eligible starting point.
You can
basically frame it into a measurement thing, which is always a broad discussion you can have about measurement once you're over the recognition hurdle. And when you then say it's not fair value of demand deposits, but we know that for demand deposits we only have a deemed fair value, which is not fair value, but we didn't find a more convincing solution. But if you then accept that you can actually only value if you want to remeasure a demand deposit, do it in the context of a portfolio, then clearly those are bought and sold with a valuation that includes the expectations of things at stake. And you also have a philosophical discussion in terms of how you treat the churn in the deposit balance. Do you do first in, first out, or last in, first out? So with all those assumptions, you can actually get a trail that conceptually is just enough, even if thin ice, but just enough to stay on the right side of the, of the conceptual divide. You just stay on the right side, whereas here you don't even have the starting anchor that then allows you to get into a measurement discussion and so on. That's the big divide, conceptually.
And for deposit, is there an implicit option written by the bank to the customer to keep putting the money in the account? No?
Well, it depends on the deposit contract.
There is an option. Once I open an account, I can put as much money I want. It's an option I have.
Yeah. There are different arrangements. So usually, as long as you're the customer, they allow you to deposit any amount. The interest that you get or don't get might already be capped to a maximum amount that you can deposit. If you deposit more, you don't get interest. And obviously, you have also the termination. So many deposit contracts could be terminated at short notice. So that all together gives you this kind of working relationship where as long as things go smoothly, you just keep doing it and you don't worry about reading the whole contract.
But it's part of the written option. The remuneration is part of the option.
To the extent that you have committed that they can deposit and that you pay interest and you can't reset the interest and can't cancel the contract, it would technically be a written option, I think.
Amaru?
Thanks. I think following the discussion, I think it's very interesting for us to be open in the discussion paper, as I guess Martin started and Jens. I just have a question, nothing to add to the discussion so far, because we are talking about options and behavior aspects, but just one question. We're almost finishing the 11 paths or steps in the discussion here, concentrating the interest rate risk macro hedge. So can you comment on something about non-financial entities and how do you intend to proceed until the conclusion of the discussion paper for this part of our users, IFRS users?
So you're right, we are now close to having the discussion and finalized about the interest rate risk bit. As I mentioned, the scoping bit will obviously be something that you need to think about. Maybe when we start drafting up, so the plan is now to draft up a summary of this model, and then once we do that, obviously we might identify some more issues where we need more flesh on the bone, and we'll ask you for another discussion so we can also beef that up in the discussion paper. Once we have put the summary together, then we want to start testing that with non-financial entities. Again, so far, I always keep a watchful eye on how the development is as we discuss interest rate risk. I still think it is at least a very good starting point to also talk about non-financial entities. So I had a little chat to Jan actually earlier about how even potentially pipeline trades might or might not be an issue for other entities. So it is on our mind.
Okay.
Very quickly, just to add to what Mauro just, because it was always, I have asked the same question a couple of times in the past, what do we do with non-financial entities who are doing the macro hedging? Can you give me just one example of a pipeline similar trade for a non-financial institution that you can think of? Because all the other ones I can think in a cash flow hedge scenario, like you have anticipated purchases, and you can do a cash flow hedge for that in the general hedging. So I'm just curious, where would be the similar analogy to do the step number?
I think what came to my mind when I discussed it with Jan earlier was if you envisage a grocery retailer, for instance.
I'm sorry?
If you envisage a grocery retailer, so just where you do your shopping and you buy pasta, that is heavily influenced, obviously, by the wheat price, because it's basically some eggs, but mostly wheat. And if you look at the supermarket price over recent month, it has been stable. In my supermarket, the price for a 500-gram pack of pasta has not changed for many months now.
You notice
these things? I monitor it. Yeah, I do not live in the ivory tower. I look at the I look at the wheat prices, and they have really had high volatility and increased massively because of the poor weather conditions in the U.S. and other growing areas. And so more 100% increase at times in the wheat price. And it has not affected yet the sales price of the pasta at all. So they also can't, obviously, in a grocery shop every day adjust the price of a pack of pasta depending on where the wheat price on the stock exchange or the commodities exchange go. So they are in a similar situation that they had to de facto keep the sales price constant, even though they're exposed to the risk that they do buy stuff and they will not be as stable unless they have contracted it. I think that in terms of the accounting solutions, to get back to that part, they would not look so much at hedging their pipeline risk. They look more at fixing the supply side. When they think that for a couple of months I can't adjust my pasta price, I just try to, at a fixed price, procure that pasta, and I can only do that with a own use delivered contract at a fixed price, or I take out a derivative that would, however, then be really a cash flow hedge of the price variations for my purchases. But if that is your natural perspective for risk management, for instance, even if you have a similar risk to pipeline trades, you would not need to have the accounting like the bank ones that actually look at it differently and really model the risk of the mortgages. Because they just say, well, we don't model our pasta sales. We just say we don't adjust the price every week or every day.
Well, I must say I'm increasingly impressed by your knowledge of our staff. And I think in the next pub quiz we should include items on household prices.
What's the price to the 500 gram?
39p.
I suppose that the staff can come back to this issue in the discussion paper. All I would like to say is that this, if we're going to go ahead with this, this is truly groundbreaking accounting, I think. And if you want groundbreaking projects to be successful, it's often better not to break too much ground and not to do things that many people might think is very extreme. My sense is that here we are reaching that edge.
A last question. How to define a pipeline trade when it exists from the day which is advertised in the shop, in the branch, or is it on the day management has decided they will launch an offer? Or yeah, there is a preparatory phase. It could take a couple of weeks before they actually launch the offer. And so the management decision creates a risk in a way, an economic risk, which becomes bigger and bigger when it is made public. And after a couple of days, it's even bigger because people become aware of that. It's not the day one, it's day two, day three. So how would we define exactly a pipeline trend in terms of risk?
Yeah, I think we would struggle to exactly define it, certainly. We can define what we mean by this and probably don't use explicitly pipeline trade in the document, but describe it and then say sometimes refer to as pipeline trade. But in terms of how you would model and quantify, I think it would be for us impossible to make those kind of prescriptive requirements because we do not know what their estimate is. So we would actually tell someone who should have a better handle on it how to do the job. I think what is interesting for people is to learn what they do about it and then also have information, for instance, like backtesting information, comparing what your forecast was and what the take-up volume really was and how much actually you then have hedged. I think that is a far more informative approach as if we try to artificially say you can only hedge a three-month period at the most with 50% haircut on the forecast volume or something like that. But that is because it's a non-existing item. It's much harder for a standard setter if you wanted to put a boundary around it, whereas for an existing item, if you have some attachment points that you can say, well, you can't overstep those marks.
Are we ready to move from pasta to floating legs?
What is that, drumsticks?
Jane?
What are the drumsticks?
Jane.
Okay, so move on to agenda paper 4A, which is credit risk and floating leg considerations. This paper continues the discussion of the proposed revaluation model. And the focus of the discussion so far has rightly been on the revaluation for the hedged portfolio, with minimal debate about the accounting treatment for the hedging derivatives. This was intentional, as one of the key assumptions within the proposed model is that hedging derivatives will be accounted for at fair value through P&L. Therefore, the revaluation model will not change the requirement for hedging derivatives to be held at fair value as defined by IFRS 13 fair value measurement. And this would include consideration of both floating leg and credit risk for the derivative. P&L volatility will arise from changes to hedging derivatives fair value due to changes in credit risk, as there is no equivalent accounting or economic offset in the proposed hedge portfolio revaluation adjustment for interest rate risk. And this would be consistent with the fact that credit risk and interest rate risk are typically managed separately. By contrast, when considering interest rate risk sensitivity, risk managers would usually include fixed and floating legs of hedging derivatives together with fixed and floating hedged instruments, making up the hedged portfolio together. Hence, the revaluation model should facilitate offset in the P&L from floating legs where offset exists economically. With that, I turn it over to the board for discussion.
There's just one statement in this paper which I wanted to comment on. I have no problem with the direction that we're steering the board. It's the last sentence of paragraph 4, and it ties back into, I think, the work that the board needs to deal with on the conceptual framework. We said there's no suggestion that accounting for macro hedging activities and the revaluation model should involve taking hedging derivatives at a fair value through P&L, either in their entirety or for particular risks. In my mind, one of the best ways to improve the acceptance of fair value and fair value measures is to do exactly that across the board. So whether you're talking about a bare biological asset, a derivative, or a forklift, to essentially diffuse the arguments for and against fair value, we should take them out of P&L. But we should have fair value and cost measures equally displayed, have equal prominence in disclosure on the balance sheet and in the P&L. And I think this essentially would go a long way to improving the understanding as well as the acceptance of things like macro hedge accounting or hedge accounting in general. So it's something that I raise because I think we're going to have to tackle the issue of what to do with fair value measures down the road. And I think one of the best ways to do it is the way we're doing it in the insurance project. The insurance project is doing exactly this. So rather than kind of doing a little bit here, a little bit there, why don't we do it consistently across the board? So that's my only observation.
Solve the conceptual framework in this project.
Stephen, you want to say something about OCI, perhaps?
I think you wanted to control it if it lowers you.
It's very tempting. I'll pass.
Well done.
My God, he's going to make it.
A pipe dream.
Pat.
I don't bite on that.
Conceptually, you know, I quite often say that you can say information is useful, but to what degree it is relevant or not is the key we should, you know, keep in mind. You know, well, PPE used for yourself, not for sale, inventory for production, of course, you know, fair value useful. You will say that I cannot deny, but to what extent, and you have to compare with the, you know, the cost and the possible reliability and others. And for us, as a standard setters, we have to make trade-off. And rather than say, if something useful, you know, we should not deny, we should not take into consideration any, you know, the cost or reliability and the threshold, just put the information there. I don't think it's a rational choice.
Well, you know, I look at the conceptual framework and we emphasize
relevance.
I remind you, we have a project going on, but
we emphasize relevance and faithful representation of information. Those are the two things we lead with.
So far, you seem to agree.
And investors would place far greater weight on relevance of information than reliability. Okay, they are far more interested in having all the pieces and make the decision as to whether or not they think this is soft information as opposed to not having that information at all. Okay? So the approach I'm talking about is to diffuse, okay, the whole issue around volatility, but provide the information.
What are we talking about?
Okay.
Can we go back to the floating legs? Any other comments?
We spoke already.
No?
Small group.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. We reconvene at 12:30 for a joint meeting with the FEB on insurance.